tape, but this is Mike Dalton, and I'm in Elbro Gregory's boudoir, his kitchen, dining room, bedroom, office,
shower,
practically in the shower. At any rate, it's a portion of the back part of the building of the Nome Nugget in Nome, Alaska.
It's 12 feet square.
12 feet square.
Most compact apartment.
You can lie in bed and cook your breakfast practically.
Sure.
Anyway, this is, as I said, Mike Dalton. This is September, what did we say, Thursday, 26. September 26, 1974, and I'm talking to Elbro Gregory. And Elbro, Lale Morgan, our mutual friend, told me when if I came to Nome and never had my tape recorder, it's sure to get you to tell me about Fred Crane's funeral. So, before you do that, if you're willing to, are you?
Yeah, sure.
Identify Fred Crane. All I know is that he was an attorney, and he was in Fairbanks for a long time.
He was in Fairbanks for several years, and before that he was in Kotzebue for a few years. And then he came over to Nome about 4 years before his death in February 1969. And I had known Fred in Fairbanks, so a number of years ago, of course. And so we got together frequently for drinks and dinner and things like that. And Fred was a real human sort of a person.
Did he practice law here in Nome?
No, he was district attorney.
Oh.
And Fred, incidentally, I said he was very human. Among his other human activities were his contributions that he made to young womanhood. It's said, and I don't know if this is official or not, but he put 16 young women through the University of Alaska or Alaska Methodist University.
Is that right?
And it kept him pretty broke all the time. And Fred was pretty proud of the fact that, can I just go ahead and...
Sure. Talk about anything you want to say.
Well, Fred was very proud of the fact he always had a chick in the sack, always kept one on hand. And Judge Sanders, William
Judge.
H. Sanders, our Superior Court presiding judge for the 2nd Judicial District of Alaska, he was telling about one time we were discussing Fred shortly after his death, and the judge recalled that the summer before, Fred came into his office and he was complaining about his stiffness in his shoulder and everything, and oh, geez, Bill, he said, God, that's stiff. The judge said, well, Fred, you must have caught a chill last night. And Fred says, yeah, I guess I did, but I told a girl twice to get up and close the window, and she wouldn't do it. The judge figured that meant he just wanted him to know it. He still had something on hand, see? And he was, I guess nobody really knew his age, but he was in his 70s. We know that at least.
Mm-hmm.
74, 70, what?
When he died.
Yeah, when he died. And so anyway, Fred was wheeling and dealing with the girls right down to the bitter end.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, when Fred got this lung condition and had to be sent out to a hospital in Seattle for care and surgery, his current chick went along to look after him. And so anyway, Fred had this operation, and it came along several weeks after that he expired there in Seattle. And so the girl elected to bring Fred home for burial, because he always said he wanted to be buried in Belmont Point Cemetery here in Nome. So that was February 1969, and
February. He was district attorney when he died. Mm-hmm. Was he still district attorney?
Yeah. And so anyway, the funeral was held in two parts, which is normal for winter deaths in Nome. They don't bury people until the next spring because of the permafrost in the ground. And Fred was out of favor with the Catholic Church.
Can't imagine why.
Oh, man.
Was he reared a Catholic? Was he Catholic?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. But the priest, Father Carroll, I believe it was then, said that they could have the funeral in the St. Joseph's Catholic Church without the Catholic rites. They could have the pioneer rites and American Legion rites. He was a World War I veteran. So that's what happened. And at the time of Nome, well, they had to use the ambulance or the hearse. Mm-hmm. And so they took the coffin up to the church and in there and had the rites. And I came on up. I was going to get a picture of them bringing the casket out of the church. And as I recall it, it was something like 35 degrees below zero that day and a little bit windy. And I got out of my pickup and went over and sat with the driver of the hearse and talking. And pretty soon, one of the fellows came out, he didn't have a parka on or anything, and he's bearing a horn under his arm. And so we got out then, and his duty was to blow taps.
For the American Legion.
Yeah, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And so we stood around there for about 5 minutes, stomping our feet to try to keep them warm. And pretty soon the priest came and stuck his head out of the front door, and he says, "Okay, John, blow the taps now." So old John put the horn up
to
the
cold horn.
And it wouldn't work. It froze up. So the priest says, "Come on in, John. We'll put it by the heating unit." So pretty soon, after about 10 minutes, well, we heard the strains of taps coming from within the church. I dare say it was the first time taps had ever been blown in a church. Well, but it wouldn't work outside, see?
Would this John, did he keep the mouthpiece warm while he was standing out in that 35?
No, uh-uh.
He must have frozen his lips.
He had a pair of gloves on. That's the only reason that his fingers didn't, you know, adhere to the metal. But it didn't take long to thaw out, and everybody just stood around and talked then, you know.
Waited for
while we were waiting for the horn to heat up.
Yeah.
So anyway, we...
Well, did the pioneers conduct the funeral service?
Yeah, pioneers and American Legion, each of their own rights. See? Mm-hmm. So then we hauled the body down to an old shack that they used for a morgue in the wintertime, and they were going to put it right on top of the casket of Wilhelmina. I know it so well, too. Wilhelmina. Oh, gosh.
Was she an old pioneer family?
Yeah, well, we could cut it in, couldn't we?
Oh, yeah.
Well, anyway, and I should...
You'll think of her name in a minute.
She was the one that... she died just before Fred, and so they had to take and push the snow off, you know, it sifted through the cracks in the shack, had to push the snow off her casket to put his on top of that. Somebody remarked that old Fred was right in the position that he liked the most, on top of some woman. Oh, God.
Did her family have him removed?
Did
they leave his casket on top of her casket?
Oh, sure. Sure, hell.
Well, he went away in glory, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, anyway, spring came, as it always does in Nome.
Well, do you have an undertaker in Nome?
Well, as there's no embalming of bodies here or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
If people want bodies embalmed, they have to send them to Anchorage. Adelaide was embalmed in Anchorage, you see, before they sent her body back up here. Yeah.
But Fred, apparently, his body probably was embalmed.
Yeah, in Seattle. But all the undertaker here does, really, is put them in a coffin and bury them, and that's it. So anyway, spring came, and so the Legion decided to have the regular cemetery service around the burial of old Fred. And it drew a big crowd. Well, I'm going to have to digress pretty soon to come back to what happened just after the funeral. Is that all right?
Well, good. Tell about it now.
Right after the funeral, then. Well, what happened, it was the first time at all the saloons in Nome, all 9 of them were closed for the funeral for an hour and a half. And Jim West of the Board of Trade Saloon down the street here had put on several cases of champagne and to cool and so on. We're going to have a wake down there right after the funeral.
At the Board of Trade.
Mm-hmm. Well, not right after. The Judge Sanders, see, we had an associate justice of the Supreme Court. We had the then Attorney General of the state of Alaska. I'm not going to mention any names of those because you'll see in a minute why. Anyway, they had this special session of the court so that people could get up and say what they thought about old Fred, you know. And they were nice, the eulogies and everything, and reminded you, you know, some of the things about Fred's past. And so then the judge said, we'll now adjourn court and we'll resume deliberations at the Board of Trade Saloon. God, Sanders would kill me if he knew I told you that, but that's the way it was. And so anyway, we all filed over to the Board of Trade Saloon. As you know, it's only about 300 feet, good and handy for the people working the federal building. Yeah. So, different ones where we would tell stories about old Fred that wouldn't have stood to be told in the courtroom. And so one of our honored guests from Anchorage, he really put the bubble water away, you know, and he had to get back to Anchorage that night, and the plane left at 9 o'clock. But when that happened, when the plane left, he was in pretty bad shape. So they got the old ambulance out there with a wire basket and backed the thing up to the Board of Trade. And they put him in this wire basket and strapped him in. And so, headed for the airport. And just about the time that they got just almost to the airport, this individual came to life and saw the curtains on the windows and all that stuff, and he swore to God he was up in heaven or someplace and seeing angels and everything else, and he let out a scream and he came out of there so fast that it broke the straps that were holding him down. So they drove the thing around to the opposite side of the airplane. They put him up forward, you know. And yeah. He was all right by the time he got to Anchorage. Well,
was he the only one who drank a little too much champagne at the wake? I imagine there were quite a few who tied one on that day.
You never saw so many drunks in your life. So, but we really had a good wake for old Fred. It should have been the night before, but some of the out-of-town guests couldn't get here in time. So, anyway, getting back to springtime, Memorial Day program and everything, and so they went to lower the casket into the grave, and the guy holding the ropes on one end, the head end of it, couldn't hold it anymore, and he let go. So the casket hit on about a 30-degree angle in the grave, and the lid kind of came back, and showed Fred's feet up forward, you know, and
were his feet headed uphill?
Head down and feet up. Oh, I don't know if it was a 30-degree angle, but anyway, there wasn't the usual required 4 feet of earth on all of the casket by any means.
Well, did he lose his grip, and then did the head end of the coffin slip?
Went down, yeah.
With a jar, and that's what opened the lid.
Yeah, So, anyway, the undertaker, they were concerned about, you know, they wonder how they're ever going to get that leveled off. But the undertaker showed up about then, his bib overalls, and he says, "Come on, you bastards, start covering that goddamn grave right now." So clunk, clunk, clunk went the chunks of permafrost on top of the casket.
Without even closing up the...
They don't have boxes, you know, as a rule, unless the family goes ahead and does it.
Well, did anyone get in the grave and close up the casket?
No.
His feet were still protruding, or...?
Yeah. Toes. Well, that's known.
Mm-hmm. So how did they dig the grave? You say they threw in permafrost back into the
You start to get some pretty nice warm weather around, as a rule, around the 1st of June during breakup.
Yeah.
See, it's breaking up then. So they take a backhoe and they keep scraping the dirt off each day
as it thaws. Yeah.
And if they get into trouble, they'll use a boiler and when they get down deeper.
I see.
That's what they did. Now, I refused to have Adelaide kept in that shack all winter, and even though it was November 3rd and her funeral, the undertaker wouldn't go ahead and dig a grave, and I raised particular hell about that because I just wasn't going to have her left there like that. So this friend of mine came in and he had equipment that could be used for that sort of thing, and he said if he had to use every bit of equipment he had in the place, well, that she was going to have a grave. So that was an unusual thing and a set of precedency, because then other people demanded it. I really put that guy on the spot, but I think there was one other. Oh, it was a National Guard sergeant that died after Adelaide died. Matter of fact, he's buried right alongside of her grave, and that was dug after hers. But there was the National Guard people, like Major Jack Fuller himself.
Mm-hmm.
And some of his non-commissioned officers and so on, they took turns down there with picks and shovels digging out that permafrost, and that's how Knockanock got his grave.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but let's get back to Fred Crane's, the undertaker here. You say he was in bib overalls the burial?
He's no longer here. It's a different one now.
And so they just threw, without even closing the lid of the... casket, or
as I recall,
down there.
They didn't.
Hi, Pierce. Come on in.
I need some
Come on in, Pete.
I need some envelopes.
What?
What's that? Slight interruption.
That's all right.
Pete Walsh. His name is Pierce, but everybody calls him Pete.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To buy some envelopes. So have a seat, Albert. I want to finish burying Fred. Memorial Day that he was buried?
Yeah, Memorial Day 1969.
Mm-hmm. And did they have the American Legion there and,
mm-hmm.
and taps and everything?
And the firing squad. I think they had 30-30s and old Springfields and
mm-hmm.
all that kind of stuff, you know. Now, wait a minute now. It wasn't the... Yeah, it was the Legion firing squad. All, and then the National Guard had a color guard. That mm-hmm. was the way it worked.
Was he the only one buried on Memorial Day?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In the spring, do they usually have three or four or five deaths during the winter, or what?
Oh, have a dozen or more.
Mm-hmm. So there's usually a big burial in the spring.
Yeah, but they just, I don't think they even tell the families when they're going to bury their dead. They just do it as they can.
I see. Well, who, is it a city cemetery, or?
Mm-hmm. And the city doesn't charge for the graves. That was the way it was set up. But you had to pay this undertaker's fee for moving the body and digging the grave and all that.
I see. But it is a city.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same graveyard that's been used in Nome since?
No. It's been used since 1913, just after the great hurricane of 1913, which washed out so many graves down here in the sand spit where the original cemetery was located.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still graves down there, though.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone by and taken pictures of these head markers and all that, you know.
Yeah.
You have to push the grass away and all
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm.
But there was nobody buried up in Belmont Point until 1913 because of that hurricane, which washed it out and everything. They selected that site up there.
Well, after Fred's burial, was there another wake or any kind of a gathering of the clan?
Yeah, I think it was kind of an informal thing, and Jim had some more champagne and all that. And,
what's Jim's last name again?
West.
Jim West from the Board of Trade?
Mm-hmm. Very affluent man here. He's deeply involved in real estate, and he has a number of apartment units, I imagine 100 or so, that he rents out.
Mm-hmm.
So on. He also deals in used cars and trucks. And
has he lived here all of his life?
No, he came here from Fairbanks about 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he had originally was in the painting contracting business. His wife, June, they have two lovely daughters that, I think one graduated last spring from the University of Alaska, and she was Miss Fairbanks.
Oh, yeah.
They look just like their mother.
Yeah.
I and that is beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that now. I didn't know she, I remember the Nome girl.
Mm-hmm. Real long, dark hair.
Well, now that we've taken care of Fred Crane, tell me about you when you first came to Nome.
Well, we came here from Petersburg the 28th day of December 1968, almost 6 years ago.
That was you and Adelaide, your late
mm-hmm.
wife.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when you came here, did you come to manage the paper, or had you purchased the Nome Ledger?
No, I came to manage it. And then we bought it 3 years ago, last April 1st. That was a good date to buy a paper, right? And it kind of ties in with the April Fool jokes, you know. It's not making $1 million a month, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Well,
making a living, though.
Making a living, and it's performs a service for the area that. There's no other newspaper in this region, is it? Well, I noticed a mimeograph.
Oh, off at Kotzebue.
Kotzebue News.
I don't think it comes out regularly, though. I could be wrong.
I purchased one. I think it was 15 cents at Rotman's store.
Mm-hmm.
I know Jane Pender started it.
Mm-hmm.
When she ran it, was it a mimeograph?
Sheet yeah.
Or,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and then she left it, you know, and I understood here some time ago that some gal that used to help her out resurrected the thing.
I see. But the Nome Nugget, isn't it just about the oldest newspaper in the state?
It is the oldest continuously operating newspaper in Alaska.
It was established when?
Established in May of 1901.
So that was about 1 year after the gold rush to Nome.
About two.
Two?
There were, in all, at the height of things, there were six newspapers in Nome.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was weekly, and it was Gnome Weekly News, and the guy that founded this paper, which was at first the Chronicle Nugget, his name was J.A.F. Strong, and he was working on the news. He had come from Dawson, you see, to establish a paper, but coming across from St. Michael, approximately the mouth of the Yukon River, got into a storm and his printing equipment was lost. So the Nome Weekly News was operating then in 1899, and so he went to work on that paper until he got ready to establish the Nugget. And those editors in those days, if they didn't have anything else to write editorials about, they would attack the their colleagues, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Wild editorials. If they ever wrote such an editorial in this enlightened day and age, we'd be sued for libel.
Yeah.
Oh, some of the things they said about each other. They think I bandy words around pretty good and get a little bit rough in editorials, but man, those guys knew no bounds at all.
Yeah. But this one was established in 1901.
1901, yeah. It's a 74th volume now.
Is that right?
Number 38 now being printed.
Do you have a complete set of the Gnome Nuggets?
No. Previous managements have apparently, or people have stolen them, I don't know, but maybe managements had taken them along for their historical value. I've got some that go back around 1914 and so on. Now, Bill Gillis, who was an old timer here and just retired and went outside, came over a few weeks ago and gave me some real old copies of it, the oldest ones I've got. And they go back to 1902. And so I enjoy taking some of those stories about shootings and things like that and different things going on around the old gold camp and printing them as is. And then at the very bottom in 6-point italic, from the Gnome Nugget of June 14th, 1902, because people just really shake them up. They say, who is that guy? I never heard of him, you know.
Yeah.
It was pretty wild around here.
Well, you publish daily, except
Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday.
So you're...
That is twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays.
Tuesdays and Fridays, so...
People start going like this when I say that, you know.
Yeah. So, what kind of staff do you have? You're the editor and the reporter and...
the photographer and...
Makeup man?
Lola Sheldon, who operates the IBM Selectric Composer, does a lot of the composition, too. And then I have a part-time bookkeeper.
Mm-hmm.
And mail kids. They're part-time, of course, after school stuff. And then we have two carrier girls and two carrier boys. And putting girls on those jobs was the idea of Adelaide.
Uh-huh.
She said girls are more dependable than boys. So we got them, and I'm real satisfied with them. Generally speaking, they've been very dependable.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with girls carrying papers. They do it all over the country.
Do, you know, a lot of girls.
They're not heavy, you know. And
yeah.
They
makes a good job for a youngster if he or she is given the total responsibility.
Yeah.
I know of some parents who will make certain that Junior gets his money over to the newspaper, and then Junior doesn't have to follow through in his own responsibility. But if it's just laid on the kid, and if he collects and Mm-hmm. It's real good training.
Well, there you have to do their collecting and everything, and turning the money in with dupes of receipts and so on. So.
Well, you spoke of Adelaide. Adelaide is your wife, and she died November.
October 30th.
October 30th. Last
she was
year.
Buried on November 3rd.
Mm-hmm. And you were married in. Were you married
in Whitehorse in Yukon Territory?
Whitehorse, is that right?
On March 4th, 1961. So we were married about 12 and a half years when she died of cancer. Mm-hmm. So. But those were happy years, and we were on the way to Ketchikan when we had to stop in Whitehorse, and she had our serologies and everything, you know, thinking we'd be required to have a blood test. But when we got there and went over to apply for a Mary's license, well, see, we were coming from Fairbanks to Ketchikan, and we got there, and they said, no, it was just 24 hours of residency. So we had another blissful night together before getting married. I shouldn't say that, should I? We used to talk about it all the time, laugh about it. So the next day, well, it was 47 degrees below zero.
That was a good reason
to stop married in the home of Harry Boyle, who was the then publisher of the Whitehorse Star, we were married by what they called a marriage commissioner, and his main job was like our fish and wildlife, our fish and game department. He was a biologist for them, and so we had a big champagne deal and quite a reception. And the next day we headed out then again, and we went down to Prince George, which is on the continuation of the Alaska Highway. I mean, you're no longer in Alaska Highway when you get down there, but we had driven all the way down the highway, of course, to Dawson Creek. And so from Highway 16 from Prince George to Prince Rupert, about 485 miles, and nothing, hardly more than a trail.
Yeah.
We left early on a Sunday morning, like 5 o'clock from Prince George, and we got to Prince Rupert at about 11 o'clock that night. So you see, we couldn't make much speed. So then we had to put our car in customs storage, and it was brought up on the first tour ship of the season in May. The Prince George, incidentally, is the name of the ship. And they just hoisted it onto the deck, and forward deck, and it cost $232 to haul that car 90 miles, and we had to fly to Ketchikan. And now when they started the ferries, now I don't know whether the prices are the same or not. I doubt that they are. I think they're higher, but we always just paid $25 to run, you know, to take the car and go down to Prince Rupert.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of difference.
Yeah, you bet. But you went to Ketchikan on the Ketchikan News?
Yeah, I went down there as managing editor of the Ketchikan Daily News in Adelaide. Went in as a director of the she's a microbiologist, and she ran the laboratory there. And then 4 years later, I guess it was, that we went to Juneau, and she went into the lab there. They had closed up the one in Ketchikan, so she.
I think that must be your,
Paula,
that's your, what's her name?
Oh, Lola.
Lola. Hi, Lola.
Hi.
That's a souvenir that I carried over the Chilkoot Pass this summer.
Oh.
I'm going to mail it to a friend of mine in Fairbanks.
And she found it on the trail.
Huh?
She found it on the Chilkoot Trail.
When you left, when you went to Whitehorse, you were leaving Fairbanks at the time.
Yeah.
You were in Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And you worked for the Fairbanks News Miner. Mm-hmm. Daily News Miner.
And then later, Jessen's Weekly.
So when you first came to Alaska, then you came up to Fairbanks then.
Yeah, but there wasn't anything for me in the News Miner, and so I took a train and went down to Anchorage and went to work on the Anchorage Daily News. Mm-hmm. And then, incidentally, did you know that Terry Tobrickson died?
No.
I got a letter from his wife Gladys, but she didn't give her address, so I couldn't answer. He died, and she said he died a horrible death. He was so sick for about a year. Mm. Well, anyway, the editor down there, I was feature editor of the Daily News in Anchorage, and the editor got the job of editor of the News Miner, taking the place of... the guy that was administrative...
Bill Strand?
Assistant, what?
Bill Strand?
No. He was with Greening. You know...
Ipling?
What?
Ipling?
No.
Sundberg.
Sundberg, yeah. George Sundberg. He was leaving to go with Greening and campaign for Greening's first run for the Senate. And after Cliff at Cernick had looked me over for a while, he said, "Would you like to go with me?" And I said, "Yeah, and I'll go because I kind of like Fairbanks, you know, what little I'd seen of it in a couple of days up there." Mm-hmm. So that's how come I went to Fairbanks.
So that was when, in 60?
No, that would have been 57.
57. Mm-hmm.
And let's see, from Juneau, of course, you knew that Hickel fired me as editor of the Juneau Empire.
I knew that he had something to do with that. I don't know what he had to do with it. I remember he was pretty furious at you.
He was. I attacked him every day, you know, during the campaign about conflict of interest. They even invited me to Washington for the hearings on him when he was going up for Interior Secretary. And I said, "You don't need to spend money on me like that. All you got to do is subpoena the copies of the Juneau Empire for that period of the campaign." And I didn't have any more than that to say. Mm-hmm. So they didn't ask me again. But anyway, then we went back to Fairbanks. I was supposed to be in public relations on A-67. Greening got me that job, and we had correspondence, and they told me what they do for me, and about moving and travel and everything else. And when I got up there, they turned me down. And all money we spent and everything to move up there, lost it all. That's a front phone. So, there we were, and the word got around awfully fast. And I got a call from Lou Williams. And
Danny is on the phone. She wants to know if you want her to pick up the mail.
Who?
Danny.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So, he called up and he said he was in trouble down in Petersburg, and he'd heard about what had happened to me, and what a dirty bunch of sons of bitches they were and all that, you know. So we made a deal, and a week after we were living in the Northwoods, see, in an apartment there, and a week after the furniture movers, that would be Sourdough Transfer, had unloaded our furniture, they were loading it again. And so...
to go back south, to Southeastern.
Yeah. And so we headed down the highway. And it took I think something like 8.5 hours to drive to Tok, 204 miles. There'd been a thaw, and the roads were just so slippery. You'd find yourself sideways.
Yeah.
It's just a wonder we didn't rhubarb, you know, a few times. So, we stayed at Mrs. Parker's Roadhouse again. We always stopped there. We even on vacation trips and everything. We just. Hi.
She said she'd be right back.
So anyway, we had a grand and glorious time that night, and next morning there were 12 inches of snow on the car.
Holy cow.
And we got to talking to a couple of kids that were students at the University of Alaska, and had decided to go to Arizona. And they were single kids, you know, and a gal and a guy, so they took off ahead of us, maybe a half an hour. So when we got down, let's see, I think it was between the Alaska border and the Beaver Creek Customs Station, the Canadian Customs Service, and just snowing, oh man, you could hardly see anything, and all of a sudden this black shape loomed up in front, and I stopped right now. And I went up and I recognized their car. And, oh, the wind was blowing so much, you know. And here the window was open on the driver's side. And the engine was running. And it wasn't real cold, you know, maybe 10 above, something like that. So I thought, what a strange thing this is, you know. And I looked around, I couldn't see anyone. I thought maybe they'd gotten out for a rest stop or something. Yeah. We hung around there for an hour and a half. I rolled up the window and
the engine was running?
Uh-huh. I did leave the engine running, you know, for fear that maybe they had battery trouble or something, yeah. Couldn't get started. And nothing doing. Well, you know, even the few and far between service stations along in that area, you know. I'll tell you what, it was south of the Beaver Creek Customs Station. Maybe, now that I think about it, I say about 30 miles maybe. Well, of course, there's no, very few of those service stations stay open all winter anyway.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, we've just got to, we got to get moving here, but this is the strangest thing. So about 25 miles farther on, we saw a light on a cabin that turned out to be a service station back there, but the road was all blocked with snow to get back into the trees where this thing was located. So I just waded in there in about 2 feet of snow. And see, you couldn't see any tracks, but tracks would have been covered from the wind, you know. So I went in there, and an old guy sitting back by a pot-bellied stove smoking a corncob pipe. And he says, yeah, he says, what are you doing out in this weather? I said, well, we're going passing through south, and told him the story. And he says, nope, haven't seen anybody. He says, you're the first one that's been by here in 2 days. He says, how are you making it in that deep snow? I said, well, I don't know. We're getting through somehow. And we thought maybe we'd run out of it, you know. And so we got to Burwash Landing. And I said, this is as far as we go until this storm is over. And we'd stayed at Burwash, too, before. We knew the people that ran it pretty well. They always remembered us when we came in. So we stayed there for 2 days. And the storm blew itself out. A road crew came in with a grader and a blower, a plow, and plowed it out. You know how far it is down to Kluane Lake, yeah. From the road, you know. Where the lodge is. So we reported there to the Mounties. That was the first place we could report anything. And I told them that I certainly hoped that they would let us know the outcome of this thing. And they promised they would, but we never heard from them. I told them we'd be in the Petersburg Press and all that, you know, and just send a letter in care of the press and that'd be fine. Never heard a word. And then later we were up there and I asked us, well, yeah, we were going to Anchorage. And the first Mountie I saw in that area, in the Yukon, I asked him about that case and he said he didn't remember it. That had been a couple of years ago. Boy, crazy. So, that was an interesting little scenario. Then, of course, you know, the rest of it, we had to come to Nome.
That's came to Nome in December of 68.
End of 68, yeah.
To manage the paper. And it was owned at that time, isn't that the time when Alaska Airlines owned it?
No, Charlie Willis owned the personal investment.
Oh, I see.
Although he was board chairman of Alaska Airlines. Mm-hmm. But he, Alaska Airlines never owned any of it.
Oh, I see. And then you eventually purchased the paper.
Yeah,
from
3 years
Willis.
Ago, last April 1st, mm-hmm. we bought it.
And Charlie Willis, he's not with Alaska Airlines now, is he?
No, he's running a charter outfit, I understand, out of Washington, D.C., down into the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And doing very well, I understand.
Well, tell me, how do you with your editorials, which get pretty colorful sometimes, how do you get along with the city council here in Nome?
Well,
do you have any battles with them?
Oh, yeah. I get along with some of the members very well.
Was that an airplane?
That was one of Munn's bush planes. Aero Commander.
You get along with some of them?
Oh, yeah. Fine, but the council itself as such, well, I have to wrap them up once in a while. Oh, I can't stand for all this indecision and everything. And like, for example, now I have racked them up good here in this editorial for tomorrow because of what they did. They voted down the opening of saloons on election days. Well, God's sake, the rest of the
state. Is it the law now in the city that saloons have to be closed during election day?
Here in the city, yeah. You see, the state law is that they can remain open.
Mm-hmm.
On election days, but they leave it to local option to make the decision whether it'll be done locally. But they voted it down.
What did someone propose an ordinance to change the law, the city law,
mm-hmm.
and then so that ordinance was voted
to allow
openings
on election days? But it was voted down. They needed 4 votes. And they only had 3 because one guy wasn't there. 3-2, 2 members against, and 3-4. But
and you must have 4 to carry the ordinance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, could someone bring it up on reconsideration?
Well, they think they're going to go in and do it, yeah. That's what they're talking about.
So that's your current little battle with
it? Yeah, that's the deal. Course,
do you have some strong opponents to the saloon business in Nome on the city council? I mean, people who'd like to
see
saloons closed up?
But you see, the trouble of it is they've gotten down to personalities.
Come on in. Where are you?
Yeah, come on in.
I gotta go home and change clothes and wash some stuff.
The voice you heard was Jenny, the girl who'd called earlier to see if Elbra wanted her to pick up the mail. Jenny's a bartender and current girlfriend of Tom Reardon, who is owner of the Breakers Bar, which is Elbra Gregory's favorite office annex. Just the day before this, Jenny had roasted a big leg of lamb roast for, rolled leg of lamb roast for Albro. Albro has this 12 by 12 apartment, which we described earlier, very compact. His cooking arrangement is a two-burner unit with a little sink next to it and a refrigerator underneath it. No oven. So Jenny had cooked him leg of lamb. It's one of his favorite foods. Albro lives by himself, but he's not by himself. He keeps his hours, at least in September of 74, his hours were early to rise, like about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. He did a lot of his good work in those hours. By noontime, when some of Nome was just stirring, Albro had been up for 6, 7, 8 hours sometimes, or even 9 hours. Some people looked askance or were aghast when Albro would wander over and have a beer or two before noon, and then right after noon have a scotch. Never drink scotch before noon. When I was there, I went over to the Breakers with Albro, and we sat there and I had two beers, and Albro just barely touched his, just played with it. The moment the clock struck noon, he pushed the can of beer aside and ordered a scotch. Albro was having an argument with one of the members of the Nome Council. Leo Rasmussen happened to be a good Republican, the Republican district chairman, as a matter of fact. And Albro, being the good Democrat that he is, had a political difference of opinion. But Leo was in favor of closing the bars on election day. Of course, this is a practically a mortal sin for old Albro to close one of his favorite drinking places. At any rate, he called him Lord Leo, editorialized on him several times, Lord Leo. Lord Leo did not get a plurality of votes in the city Nome election. They had a runoff, and Lord Leo, as Albro called him, was defeated. So Lord Leo lost, and Albro won that one.